Testing. Well, good day, everyone. Welcome to Dr. Hugh Ross's Paradox class. Every week we're getting a few more people live. It's really good to see everyone. Good morning or good afternoon, I guess. Good evening if you're online in Europe. I want to welcome everybody. Dr. Ross is with us this morning. Dr. Ross will be with us for the next four weeks. Okay, so let's put it this way. Every Sunday until April 23rd, when Mark Clark is going to be with us again. Mark Clark, he was just here last week, right? He was really terrific, so he's going to come back. And then Robert Cavolo is going to finish his series directly after that, April 30, May 7, May 14. So Hugh's going to be with us until April 23rd. I want to thank the really great people that bring treats to Paradox class, because that's what makes this a wonderful class, other than Hugh Ross, of course. So thank you, Val Durham, and thank you to my wonderful wife, Susan. Say, give them a round of applause for them. And Anne Marie. Yeah, Marie Ann. Yes, sorry. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, this is really important. You ready for this? You listening? Okay. A biologist, a chemist, and a statistician are out hunting. The biologist shoots at a deer and misses 5 feet to the left. The chemist takes a shot and misses 5 feet to the right. The statistician yells, "We got him!" Finally, everybody laughed at one of the jokes I told. This is great. Okay, we are getting back into the rhythm. Let's say a prayer and we'll get to Dr. Hugh Ross. Heavenly Father, thank you, thank you, thank you that we live in a country where we can profess our faith openly, that we can argue and debate our views. Lord, I just am so grateful that we live in this rare moment in history and place in history where we have that luxury. It's not a normal thing in human history. I'm so grateful. Thank you for this class. Thank you for Dr. Hugh Ross. We ask your blessing on his teaching today and on each of us as we go our way this afternoon. Thank you. In Jesus' very precious name, amen. Please welcome Dr. Hugh Ross.
Well, we've been doing a series on human exceptionalism, and we started off the series by making the point that the Christian faith rises and falls on three fundamental evidences. Number one, Jesus rose bodily from the dead, and the historical evidence for the bodily resurrection of Jesus from the dead is overwhelming. Cornerstone of the Christian faith. Another cornerstone, there is a creator who created the universe. There's a beginning to the universe. The beginning of space and time itself. And of all the world's holy books, only the Bible teaches that God not only created matter and energy, he created space and time, he created the universe. The third fundamental doctrine is that we human beings are exceptional. We're unique amongst all forms of life that God created, in that we alone have been created in the image of God. But as I've been sharing with you these past few weeks, all three of these doctrines are under attack today. And probably the one that's under the greatest recent attack by research scientists, both within the Christian community and outside the Christian community, is this doctrine of human exceptionalism. And the Bible tells us that we are fearfully and wonderfully made. And it's reached a point now where of all the science faith organizations, Reasons to Believe stands alone in saying that we humans are distinct from the Neanderthals and the Denisovans. What I'm finding is young earth creationists, theistic evolutionists, evolutionary creationists, they all agree with one another that Neanderthals are fully human. They have different ideas of how they fit into the biblical picture, but they all agree that Neanderthals are fully human. We at Reasons to Believe are standing apart from that and saying, no, the Neanderthals are not human, only we humans are truly human. And so this is why we've been spending some time, are Neanderthals human? And here's what I find ironic. When I go and talk to scientists, physical anthropologists who are not believers, I find a number of them who agree with us at Reasons to Believe Neanderthals are not human, that there's something exceptional about what we refer to as modern humans. And I remember 40, 50, 60 years ago, the claim was being made in the scientific literature, well, of course Neanderthals are human, they're anatomically identical to us humans. Well, what I'm finding is neither young earth creationists, theistic evolutionists, or evolutionary creationists are now making that claim. The evidence is just too obvious that we are anatomically distinct. And a couple of weeks ago, I showed you this side-by-side comparison of the human skull and the Neanderthal skull. This is just one of several pieces of evidence that tell us you really can't sustain the idea that humans and Neanderthals are anatomically distinct. Just look at the skull structure difference. And the way this is portrayed, it makes it look like the Neanderthal brain cranium is bigger than ours. It's because you're only seeing one view. The Neanderthal brain is more like a cylinder. Ours is more like a basketball. And so with the Neanderthal brain, they have a thin skull that goes out to the back. The human skull is more globular, and it's a globular-shaped skull of ours that allows us to have large parietal lobes, the lobes you need to do theology, philosophy, mathematics, and physics, and the sciences. And so it is true that Neanderthals' brains are about the same size as human brains, but the shapes are radically different. And by the way, we humans have a higher encephalization ratio. What that means is the weight of the brain relative to the weight of the rest of the body, because Neanderthal was much heavier and more muscular than we human beings, and a lot of the brain of the Neanderthal was to support that extra muscle that the Neanderthal had, whereas we have a brain that's the same size, but being the same size, more of our brain can be used for sophisticated thinking. And we are the only species that thinks all the time. You may not know this, but as a human, you're addicted to thinking. You can't stop thinking. And we got some messages, we'll talk about that. This map here shows you the geographical extent of the Neanderthals. And yes, most of the finds are in Spain and France and Italy, but they've been found in Romania, southern Germany, southern Britain, out as far as western Siberia, and then in the Fertile Crescent, they're also found. But they existed at a much lower population level than we humans. This entire range you see here, it included about 8,000 Neanderthals. So there weren't that many of them. But as I read the scientific literature, there are three primary pieces of evidence that are thrown out to make the claim that Neanderthals are fully human and just as intellectually advanced as we human beings are. When I was here 2 weeks ago, oh, and by the way, thank you for showing such great hospitality to Dr. Mark Clark. I got a ton of feedback from you and those of you online, just how much you enjoyed Dr. Mark Clark. And I'm glad that he's going to take my place when I'm going to be speaking in Washington, D.C. At the end of April. So thank you for being willing to have him come back. He's got a bunch of messages. So he's not just able to give two or three. He can give a whole lot of messages. By the way, he came to this class, some 35 years ago. And he came as a very committed young earth creationist. His parents were attending here, and he was very disturbed that his parents were actually attending this class taught by a heretic. And so what they said is, well, why don't you come and prove Dr. Ross wrong? Just, you know, listen, and, you know, he takes questions. Do what you can to prove him wrong. And so Mark Clark came to this class. He started asking questions. And after six Sundays of coming here, he was no longer a young earth creationist and became a very excited participant in the Reasons to Believe organization. But yes, when I was here 2 weeks ago, I talked about one recent challenge to the idea. And incidentally, one reason I'm focused on making the point that we humans and Neanderthals are distinct is what I'm seeing in the scientific literature, the motivation for trying to include Neanderthals as part of the human species is to make us less exceptional than we think we are, less exceptional than what the Bible says. So the attempt is really to bring down humanity to the level of Neanderthals. Of course, this isn't new. There's been wives for centuries have been complaining that their husbands were Neanderthals. So this is not something that's new. But in the scientific literature, I see this motivation really trying to bring us humans down to the level of Neanderthals. But as I mentioned 2 weeks ago, one of the challenges is to say, look, we found this tiny piece of twine, a three-stranded piece that was 6 millimeters long, and the knot was 1 millimeter, and they're saying a Neanderthal must have made that, and if a Neanderthal made that, the Neanderthal must be capable of mathematical set theory. You can get the recording, by the way. We got two cameras here. We record every session of Reasons to Believe. So if you've missed that, you can go to paradoxes.org and watch that. But today I want to get to the two other major challenges that are being put forward to make the claim that Neanderthals are fully human and that we're no smarter than what the Neanderthals are. We're not sophisticated. We're really not exceptional. So one is the claim of the twine. The other one is the claim that they were using sophisticated spears, the Schoenigen spears. These are a set of spears that were discovered in Germany in a place where Neanderthals were inhabiting, and they're claiming these spears are so sophisticated that they had to be fully human. And the third claim is a claim that Neanderthals were manufacturing complex musical instruments, the claim of the Neanderthal flute. So I'm going to deal with the spears first. And so this actually is a photograph of two of these Schoenigen spears. They found a total of 10 of these spears. 9 are made out of spruce, 1 is made out of pine. And so here's one actually showing a reconstruction. These are not the actual spears that they had found in Germany. What they did is they went onto a forest and basically said, we're going to do what the Neanderthals did, break branches off the trees, we're going to shape them and sharpen them. And so this is actually in a museum in Germany where they say, hey, these aren't the actual spears, but we think they're very close to what the spears look like. But the claim that's being made in the scientific literature, and it's in the theological literature, William Lane Craig has written about this in his book on human origins. Peter Enns was the first to make the claim, and he says, these pieces of wood that we're finding are identical to Olympic javelins. Well, they're not quite identical. As you can see, there's a bit of a bend in it. Last time I checked with an Olympic javelin, they were completely straight. But what they are pointing out, and if you read the scientific literature, nothing in the scientific literature is saying these are identical to the javelins that are used in the Olympics. That's only in the Christian theological literature. But I've been quite shocked at how many times that claim is repeated in the theological research literature, that these spears that they have found are identical to Olympic javelins. But in the scientific literature, that claim is never made. And as I said, of the 10 spears they have found, 9 are made out of spruce wood, 1 is made out of pine. And incidentally, if you've ever seen an Olympic javelin, they have a metal tip. These are 100% wood. And they don't make Olympic javelins by breaking branches off of trees and sharpening with their teeth. No, they're actually taking a piece of wood and they machine it or out of and make the spear. And this is actually a close-up showing this is the best preserved of the Shawinigan spears. And so the others are more decayed than this one. And none of them are perfectly straight. So this is about average in terms of how straight they are. They do have a point. And if you look at that extreme right, you can see that as evidence of being sharpened. And that's where they're saying these Neanderthals had to be quite sophisticated because they're actually sharpening the tip of the teeth of the spear. And yes, these could be potentially thrown to make a kill of a large animal or to defend themselves from another predator. Now, here are some of the details. That's the best specimen that's been found. But here are some of the details, is that they do have these things dated by thermoluminescence, and the dates are coming in between 337,000 years ago and 300,000 years ago. So based on this, they're saying there's no way they can be attributed to modern humans because modern humans didn't make it into southern Germany until about 40 to 45,000 years ago. Now, because it's thermoluminescence, what they're basically doing is, this is not a radiocarbon date. What they're doing is they're looking at the layer in which the spear is found. So this isn't actually a date of the spears. They didn't take a sample from the spear and get a date. What they were doing was dating the dirt in which this spear was found. And the problem with that is dirt moves. And so it's not necessarily the original dirt that was attached to the spear. And by thermoluminescence, what they're measuring, they're looking at little crystals within that dirt. And when they're illuminated by light, they phosphoresce. So it's a lot like what we did with our boys when they were young, is that I went into their bedrooms and I put on the walls or on the ceilings of their rooms these phosphorescent stars, because I wanted them to be able to figure out where north was by looking at the Big Dipper and the Little Dipper. So I put the Big Dipper and Little Dipper stars up on the wall, and they were always amazed that I could tell that they had turned their lights on after they had gone to bed, because I'd walk into their room an hour later and I could still see that these stars were well illuminated. Did you turn the light on? How did you know, Dad? Well, because it takes time for that to go. In an hour, they should be completely dark. Well, the same technique is used in trying to date this dirt. They basically look at these crystals, because these are spears that are found in caves. And so they're basically dating the amount of time from when, say, the Neanderthal took a branch off the tree, sharpened the branch, took all the leaves and branches off, and then brought it into the cave. And once inside the cave, it was no longer exposed to sunlight. So they're dating how long it's been kept in the dark. But that presumes that the spear was never re-exposed, that the spear was never taken out of the cave or brought back into the cave. And it's also making the presumption that there's been no disturbance of the dirt that was next to the spear. I've written an article, as you'll find at reasons.org, saying that the error bar on thermoluminescence can be as large as plus or minus 2,000%. So the date that's in the scientific literature is 337,000 to 300,000 years ago. The error bar on that date is plus or minus 20,000 years, but that's only the statistical error. It's not the systematic error. A systematic error would be introduced if that dirt was moved or the spear was moved. That would throw all the dates off, up or down. So, but most scientists are confident that these dates are sufficiently far back in time that it can't be attributed to modern humans. And you'll say, well, do Neanderthals go back that far? There's no doubt in the scientific literature that they date back at least 275,000 years. There are papers saying that Neanderthals have been around as far back as 400,000 years ago. So this date is within the range of the earliest of the Neanderthals. Okay, point number two. When they go into the caves where they found these spears, they can't find any evidence of hominid remains. And so they got the spears, but there's no bones of Neanderthals. There's nothing else that would be Neanderthal and then Neanderthal implement. They only find the pieces of the wood. And it's wood only, and they're not branches, pardon me, they're from the trunks of young spruce and pine trees. So they look for a young spruce tree, and they grab the trunk and strip all the branches off. That way they get a reasonably straight piece of wood. And the claim is that Neanderthals were using these pieces of wood to hunt wild horses, where they would trap them by a lake shore, because they found evidence of an old lake shore that was near this cave. And they said, well, maybe that's what the Neanderthals were doing. They would get a group of them with these spears, and they would trap the horses by the lake, and then they would kill the horses and get horse meat. Or they're claiming that they were used to fend off bears, lions, tigers, and wolves. The bears is actually a reasonable presumption, because they've also found evidence that bears were using caves. Bears hibernate, and so they look for caves as a place where they can retain their body heat in the wintertime. So they do see evidence of bears, and they said, well, bears are fierce competition for humans, and so maybe they were using these spears to defend themselves from bears. But notice I put question marks by both of them. There is no evidence to sustain, other than the fact that they found these spears, to sustain that these spears are being used. And there's been some science research paper saying, we don't think these are spears at all. We think they're walking sticks. And so the claim that they are actual spears used for hunting or defense, again, it's questionable. And what you will see in the scientific literature, these spears are similar in weight and balance to Olympic javelins. But again, we have these well-known, famous Christian theologians saying they're identical to Olympic javelins. What actually it says in the research paper is they're roughly the same weight and the same length as Olympic javelins. Now, the fact that they're looking at these pieces of wood is evidence that Neanderthals are fully human. We've written articles at reasons.org to say, no, wait a minute. It's not just Neanderthals amongst non-human primates where we see the use of spears. We see it in real time with chimpanzees. And it's not just the fact that we find pieces of wood that are in the same territory as chimpanzees. You can actually watch video clips of chimpanzees in the wild breaking branches off of a tree, using their teeth to sharpen the point of the branch, stripping all the branches off, side branches off, and using this spear to hunt bush babies. Now, the spears are not as long as Olympic javelins. After all, chimpanzees top out at about 80 pounds body weight. And so, yes, their spears are shorter. And of course, what they're trying to hunt are not horses or deer. They're hunting these small bush babies. So they're using smaller spears. But if you look at the spears that are being used by chimpanzees that we actually observe in real time in the field, they're just as sophisticated, if not more sophisticated, than these Shunagan spears. They're straighter, and they're more. And what you also see is that chimpanzees will be breaking off these branches, stripping off the side branches, sharpening them. But when they find that another chimpanzee has got like a little longer one or a little shorter one, they might throw theirs away and grab a new one. In other words, these chimpanzees actually experiment to see what kind of piece of wood is more effective for killing bush babies. And so over time you discover, well, these chimpanzees are all using spears of about the same length and the same weight, because they quickly determine by trial and error which spears are most effective for killing the bush babies. And for that reason, I think there is an explanation for why the Shunagan spears that they've all found are roughly the same weight and the same length. Neanderthals would have used the same approach as chimpanzees in figuring out, okay, which pieces of wood would be most effective in hunting the prey we're intending to hunt, or defending ourselves against, say, saber-toothed tigers and bears and other threats to their survival. Now, I don't know of any modern-day anthropologist that would ever claim that chimpanzees are fully human. And what we see here is nothing of any greater significance than what we see with chimpanzees. So why are we citing these Shunagan spears? And by the way, only 10 have been found in one location. It's not like we're finding spears in all the locations. Just one cave in Germany. We don't find anything in France or Spain or Italy or Britain. It's just this one location. And yet with the chimpanzees, we see that wherever there's bush babies, we see chimpanzee spears. So there's a lot of evidence that spear use by chimpanzees is ubiquitous. We do not see that evidence with Neanderthals. We just have this one limited claim. And yet I was at a conference with theologians not too long ago where they were all insisting that the Shunagan spears prove that Neanderthals are fully human, and therefore that Adam and Eve gave birth not just to us, but gave birth to all the Neanderthals and the Denisovans. Okay, well, let's look at another claim. Excuse me. And the third claim is a Neanderthal flute, saying Neanderthals must be fully human, they must be incredibly advanced just like us, because they were capable not only of manufacturing musical instruments, they must have been capable of composing and playing complex music. And so this is the Neanderthal flute that they have found. It's a fragment of a bear's cub's femur. So it's the long leg bone of a bear, but it was taken from a cub, not a fully formed bear. And this was found in a cave in Slovenia in 1995. And to give you some idea of its length, it's 11.4 centimeters, or about 4.5 inches long. So what they found is about that long. Hey, thank you for the water. And they were able to come up with a carbon-14 date, not of this bone. They weren't able to do that. Technically, it could be done, but it hasn't been done. But what they did is they found a bit of charcoal that was in the same layer in which this bone was found, and they dated that at 43,000 years ago. However, that's not what you see in the scientific literature, not in the recent literature. It's in the older literature. Another team of scientists said, well, let's do electron spin resonance of that same layer, and they came up with a date of 50 to 60,000 years ago. And because of that date, they said this couldn't have been manufactured by a human, because humans were not there that long ago. And by the way, it's discovered in Slovenia, which is kind of like where it's near the Austrian border is where they found this. And so they're saying, well, humans didn't get there until 40 to 45,000 years ago. So it can't be a human flute. It has to be a Neanderthal flute. And you say, what's this electron spin resonance? It's a lot like thermoluminescence. They're looking at the spins of the electrons, but it's basically the same technique. They're measuring how long this flute has been kept away from sunlight. And here again, you're making the presumption that the flute wasn't moved and the dirt wasn't moved. That may not be true, in which case this date of 50 to 60,000 years ago may not be accurate. And incidentally, the charcoal doesn't necessarily give you an accurate date either, even though it is carbon-14. Again, you have to assume that the flute and the dirt have been undisturbed for 43,000 years. That may not be the case. This is the cave in which they found it. It's a really big cave. You can walk around in it. And it's a cave where they have found over 600 ancient relics. Some of these relics are definitely attributed to modern humans. Others are Neanderthals. And some are even can be attributed to the bears. And so we now know this big cave was used by bears, it was used by Neanderthals, it was used by modern humans over a period that extends from yesterday all the way to 50,000 years ago. And so part of the problem is, how do you determine whether this relic is a Neanderthal relic or a modern human relic? And again, and they found over 10 different layers, 10 layers that they think date at different times, but again, the presumption is that the layers have not been preserved. Now, the scientific papers that are claiming this is actually a musical instrument, they're claiming that they got evidence for 5 holes. Now, what I showed you back here is you got 2 holes, right? But they're saying, well, actually, if we look at this in a little more detail, we have evidence for 5 holes. And so you see the 2 holes on the top, and they claim that the hole number 2 goes all the way through to the back. But if we were to turn that flute over, the back part in that area is completely missing. It's corroded away. But they're presuming that the hole was punctured all the way through with that exact shape. Well, possibly, but the whole point is that back half of the section towards the left is simply missing on the back. But they're claiming that's hole number 3. And then they're claiming number 1, there was a hole there that of a much longer piece. And then hole number 5 is where that rod is. Well, again, you have to presume that that broken off piece is actually where the holes were. And here's what they're trying to do and trying to claim that this is a true Neanderthal musical instrument is that they're saying, well, it was actually a much longer piece, and this is all we got left. We only have 2 holes that we know for sure are holes, but here we think are all the other holes that would have been part of this. And what's caused theologians to draw the conclusion that this indeed was a sophisticated musical instrument is that some physical anthropologists who were classical musicians, what they did is they made what they call replicas of this Neanderthal flute. So this is what the flute looks like, and they go back here and say, well, we just tried to reconstruct it, and they put 3 holes in it, and then they had 1 hole going all the way through, and there's a famous video clip where it shows this musician taking this reconstruction of this so-called Neanderthal flute and put it in his mouth because the front piece there is big where your mouth can go over it, and he was able to play a complex tune with this reconstruction. But then papers have also been published saying, well, the reconstruction isn't exactly like the Neanderthal flute. There are differences. And so there's claiming, so notice how smooth that is. The bone is all nicely polished. And we talked about the Neanderthal twine 2 weeks ago and how the rebuttal was the Neanderthal simply didn't have the dexterity or the eye-hand coordination to be able to make that twine. Neither would the Neanderthal have the dexterity and the eye-hand coordination to make something as sophisticated as this, where it's nicely polished. The holes are polished. The holes are all the same size. As you look back at this particular thing, we only have clear evidence of two holes. The two holes are not identical. You can see that they're misaligned, and they're not perfectly circular, and it's a big guess whether or not those other holes were really there. But this is really what got people excited, saying Neanderthals have to be just as musically accomplished as us, because look at this anthropologist who is able to play a complex tune with this reconstruction. So, and what you see at the Slovenian National Museum, where this flute is displayed and the reconstructions are displayed, you actually see an inscription beneath the flute where it says, quote, "Neanderthals were capable of such an abstract and uniquely human activity as creating music. They were able to create musical instruments and actually compose complex music." Well, you know, there's really nothing in this particular find that would make you draw the conclusion or jump to the conclusion that they were capable of composing a symphony and playing it on this flute. Maybe they're just making noises. However, as I've read the scientific literature, you do see these claims in the peer-reviewed scientific literature decades ago that this was a Neanderthal flute. But you see many more research papers claiming it's not a flute at all. Here's just one example, and it's taken from this paper here, published in the Royal Society Open Science Journal with the title, "Neanderthal Bone Flutes," in quotes, "Simply Products of Ice Age Spotted Hyena Scavenging Activities on Cave Bear Cubs in European Cave Bear Dens." So I got the paper up here if you'd like to read it. But one quote by the author, he says, "All such instruments attributed to Neanderthals are simply chew toys of animals." And if any of you have had a pet dog, you know, throw the dog a bone, the dog will gnaw on the bone, and the dog will keep working on the bone and eventually either puncture the bone or crack the bone. And what this author is claiming is, what we see here in this particular small piece of a bear cub femur, it is something that we would expect would be created by hyenas trapping a small bear cub, killing it and eating it, and then beginning to chew on the bones, because inside the bones are marrow. And wild animals realize there's a lot of nutrition to be gained by getting that marrow out. And so they'd be highly motivated to puncture it. And they said, look at the backside. The backside is, you know, there's nothing on the backside that shows that this piece of this femur was intact. It's completely corroded away. And they're saying this is what you'd expect if an animal was chewing on it to get the bone marrow out. You see two holes on top made by the teeth, but on the back, it's completely chewed away. And again, anyone who's watched a band, and he says, there's been a lot of speculation in scientific literature. Is these holes made by saber-toothed tigers? Was it made by lions? Was it made by some other creature? But he's making the point that where you see this behavior most frequently used is hyenas, because hyenas will scavenge. And it says, is there evidence that hyenas were common in that area? Yes. They're not there now. There are no hyenas in Slovenia, but if you go back to the time of the Neanderthals, there were literally thousands of hyenas wandering around. And if you ever watched any of these clips of hyenas in Africa, what they do is they wait for lions or cheetahs to make a kill. And then a band of them will chase off the lions or the cheetah, and especially with cheetahs, because cheetahs are not that strong. And what you notice with cheetahs, over half the kills that they make, they don't get to eat. They get chased off by wild dogs or these hyenas, and they come in. Or what the hyenas will do with lions, lions will eat the best off the carcass, but they leave the bones. So the hyenas come in and they say, okay, we're gonna scrape all the meat off the bones, puncture the bones, and get the marrow. So he makes a case that, hey, This is something, nothing more than hyenas taking advantage of this. And yes, the fact that it was a bear cub makes all the more sense in this. Well, I've gone 34 minutes, so I'm going to stop here because we're trying to keep the class time to teaching time to about 30 to 35 minutes. So we'll pick this up next week. But we'll take the time for questions and discussion. And as always, I'll take questions on any topic. It doesn't have to be what we're discussing today. And we're going to alternate between those of you that are here in person and those of you that are participating virtually online. So I'll let you moderate, Ross. What's the first question?
Hugh, I'm surprised by the discussion about tool use in Neanderthals because I had thought pretty much the scientific community had given up on the idea that tool use at all is anything special to human, especially after discovering crows making beautiful hooks. If nobody's aware of that, we have a group of crows that are able to make fishing hooks. They use it to hunt worms, but they look like human fishing hooks, just beautiful, I mean, better than I could make. And once that was discovered, I thought the scientific community had given up tool use as related to humans, you know, at all. So I'm surprised by that. Is that still the case that these javelins are taken seriously as any connection for being human based on what we, because if we do that, then we have to say crows are human. You know, with the chimpanzees, at least they're primates. So you can say, okay, primates make tools. But once we find the crows, which aren't related to primates at all, I thought tool use had been given up on this discussion of linking to human activity at all.
Good point. And there are papers in the literature making the claim that, you know, from a naturalistic perspective, you would make the claim that the animals that look most like us are also going to be intellectually most similar to us. And you're right. What we see with the birds basically establishes that what Darwin claimed, that the animals that look most like us, namely the large primates, are also going to be most similar to us intellectually, has been refuted by research on Caledonian crows and ravens. Caledonian crows and ravens far surpass chimpanzees and orangutans in their intellectual capability. Chimpanzees and orangutans, they do use tools, but what you see with the Caledonian crows and the ravens, they'll use tools to recover a tool to get a food treat. And they are capable of doing an 8-step process to solve a problem to get a food treat, whereas chimpanzees and orangutans are capable of 1-step. Now, it is true that they've been able to train chimpanzees to do a 2-step process, but that only happens when the chimpanzee becomes a pet of the human. So without that human connection, they're limited to 1-step, whereas wild Caledonian crows are capable of an 8-step tool use thing. And you can watch these video clips. I mean, it really is quite amazing what they can do. The other thing we notice is that Caledonian crows and ravens have a 3-part cranial structure that's similar to what we see in the human skull. And chimpanzees and orangutans don't have that cranial structure. So we share that in common with the birds. So when you claim that somebody's a bird brain, it may not necessarily be an insult. So, but I think one reason why you do see in the scientific literature the claim that Neanderthals were sophisticated tool use is the size of their tools. So, you know, because the tools that the birds are using are small, but the tools that these we see there. And I wrote I don't think I've discussed it here in class, but I wrote an article. It's at reasons.org. I put out a weekly blog called Today's New Reason to Believe. And one was on the capuchin monkeys that they have found in Brazil and how they now know that capuchin monkeys are capable of more sophisticated tool use than the chimpanzees and orangutans. So amongst the primates, the non-human primates, chimpanzees are not at the top of the pile. It's these small monkeys in Brazil that have demonstrated it. And it actually caused people to reconsider the date for when humans entered North and South America. Because they found in five different sites in Brazil these sophisticated tools, so-called sophisticated tools, and they're claiming that the appearance of these tools, which were dated to be between 40 and 50,000 years ago, were evidence that humans had made it into central Brazil 40 to 50,000 years ago. But the latest research is saying they're not made by humans at all. The Capuchin monkeys made them, because we see them making them to this very day. So what they thought were human tools really were tools that were being used by monkeys. And I wrote a paper on why we now know they couldn't have been made by humans. They had to be made by these monkeys, which has basically resolved a huge problem. Because nowhere else in the Americas do we see evidence of humans coming in any earlier than 17,000 years ago. 15,000 years is undisputed. Earlier than 15,000 is disputed. But there's some people saying 17, but nobody was saying 40 to 50,000 years. The only place was in these central jungles of Brazil. So, but that hopefully that answers your question as to why they're jumping to all these conclusions. And what you actually see in the scientific literature, in my opinion, is you've got two groups of physical anthropologists. One group who desperately wants Neanderthals to be fully human because it fits their philosophical worldview, whereas others are saying, no, we humans really are distinct, and we're way beyond the capability of these Neanderthals and Denisovans. So there is a debate going on amongst atheistic physical anthropologists. In fact, I can tell you a story. My colleague Fazal Rana was at a major conference back east where they assembled these theologians and anthropologists to discuss this issue of human exceptionalism and were Neanderthals fully human or not. And it was an atheist anthropologist who kind of nudged Fuzz and said, you know what, we have all these theistic evolutionists here, but I got way more in common with you than I got with them. Because he was basically saying there's no way, looking at the scientific evidence, you could draw any other conclusion in that we humans really are exceptional Neanderthals and the Denisovans and the Homo erectus species are not. So I find that rather ironic. We got more in common with the atheistic, some of the atheistic physical anthropologists than we do with these theologians. Okay, next question.
Maritza Caraballo in Houston asks online, are small children before the age of accountability going to be raptured? Thank you for your response.
Okay, age of accountability. There's a debate within the Christian community about when do small children become responsible for the behavior. And so those who believe in the age of accountability are basically saying, up until a child reaches a certain age, they are innocent. And if they die before that age, they automatically go to heaven because they haven't lived long enough to really be judged for their sin. And it's basically a debate. Are young children really in a state of sin, or do they become in a state of sin at a later age? My personal position, and this is a personal position, but I've checked with the scholars at Reasons to Believe, and this is one place where we all agree. None of us hold to the doctrine of the age of accountability. We all believe that whatever your age is as a human being, you are a sinner before God, and therefore, if a child dies at the age of two, they're in the same position as the rest of us. With one important caveat, Jesus said, to whom much is given, much is expected. And so those of us who have, you know, normal intelligence and have lived a while, we're going to be held accountable because we've been able to receive more from God than those who have received less. But on that basis, Jesus' words is basically saying we're all accountable, just saying for whom less has been given, less is expected, but something is still expected, even of the young child. And I think that the basis of this doctrine of the age of accountability is his idea that when children are born, they're not yet sinners. But then you got King David saying in Psalm 51, verse 5, that he was a sinner from the time he was conceived. So in that basis, that means that the doctrine of original sin still holds. By the way, the next book I got coming out, part of it's a book on the defense of biblical inerrancy, but part of what I do is defend the doctrine of original sin. And this, to me, has been alarming, that only in the 21st century have we seen conservative theologians saying we have to abandon the doctrine of original sin. And what's driving them is this very debate over human exceptionalism. They're saying, if we have to accept what we're seeing in the scientific literature, that we humans have been here a long time, that Neanderthals are part of the human race, and that we came from a population, not from just two individuals, then we have to abandon the doctrine of original sin. So anyway, I got a book coming out defending the doctrine of original sin. But I do hold to that doctrine that we're all accountable before God. And, you know, across the street from Christ Church of Sierra Madre is a facility for doubly handicapped people. And some of them have actually been participating with us here in class. You know, and these are typically people that have two or more significant handicaps, including some mental challenges that they have. And so people are claiming, well, if you're in that category, you're also part of this group where if you die, you automatically go to heaven. And it's based on the idea that the only way you can be saved is to have a certain intellectual capability and to have lived long enough. I believe God has ways to communicate to the fetus inside the womb. He doesn't communicate to that fetus the same way he communicates to us, but he does communicate. After all, we're spirit beings. So I claim that we don't need to have a large, well-developed brain. We don't need to have our five senses intact in order to receive communication from God. And you actually got the explicit statement in the book of John, chapter 1 and chapter 3, that God's light has gone out into the whole world and that all humans receive light from God. And if we receive that light, we proceed towards salvation. If we reject that light, we proceed towards condemnation. What you see in John 1 and John 3 implies that God's light goes out to every human being, including the fetus in the womb. So on that basis, we'll all be judged, but we'll be judged on the light, on what we've done with the light that we receive from God. But hey, there are Christians that disagree with me, so I don't want to come across too dogmatically on this. Yes?
Okay, so back to the image that's on the screen right now. I'm just curious about how there would be two circles exactly the same size and that would be caused by a chew toy. I mean, I'm just wondering how do you get that?
Well, there are people who have said this has to be done by Neanderthals, or claiming that what Neanderthals had was some kind of a piercing tool that they put on this femur, and they took a rock and kind of did this. And there's anthropologists have pointed out is that, we don't have any evidence that's not disputed of Neanderthals using two tools at the same time. We do have evidence, as we do with the chimpanzees and the capuchin monkeys, that they were taking rocks and using that to pound, break open nuts and things like that. But this is a case where you got a piercing instrument and a rock on top of it like a hammer, and they said, well, that could explain the holes, but we don't have any supporting evidence that Neanderthals had that capability. And what's interesting is when you come to the first flutes made by humans, they're not made out of bones. They're made out of ivory. And so these humans would take a tusk, say, from an elephant, and then they would drill through it, and then they would make holes on it, and then we'd get perfectly round holes. But people said, yes, The holes are about the same size, but they're not identical in shape, and they're saying they had to be made by the same teeth. And so if you got these big incisor teeth, you would expect the holes to be the same size. That's the claim of this author. He's just saying the reason why the holes are the same size, they're made by the same teeth. So, and it says the fact is, we see these kinds of holes in bones that are given to hyenas. We actually have real-time evidence that they can duplicate something like this.
Hugh Valderum wants to know, couldn't the spears attributed to Neanderthal be made? Boy, and then it just disappears. You gotta go all the way out and come back. There it is. Couldn't the spears attributed to Neanderthal be made by Homo erectus? I think the latter were present to about 200,000 years ago.
Yes, that is a possibility. I mean, the date range was 337,000 to 300,000 years ago. So maybe it's not Neanderthal. Maybe it's Homo erectus. That's certainly a possibility. But the evidence we have for sophisticated tool use of Homo erectus is quite a bit below that what we see for Neanderthals. You really do see a different level of tool manufacture with Neanderthals than you do with Homo erectus. So that's kind of why the literature, but I don't know of any papers claiming that this is a Homo erectus thing. But as this paper is saying, he's basically saying, we don't think it was manufactured at all. This is just simply animals that made this. But another thing that is in the scientific literature is that people are claiming this really is a musical instrument, but it's made by modern humans. It's not made by Neanderthals, because you do have that radiocarbon date of 45,000 years ago. But I want to be clear, neither the radiocarbon date nor the, the electron spin resonance date can be considered to be reliable dates. They might be, but it's simply a possibility. So who knows what the real date is for this thing. But one reason why you see a reluctance to attribute this to humans were making them out of ivory, not out of bones. But hey, humans could have made it out of bones. So if I were to go back to, here. This is one where modern day humans did indeed make a flute out of a bear femur. But again, as I mentioned, it's a big jump to claim that Neanderthals were capable of making something of that ilk. I think I have to turn mine off.
There we go. I was kind of lightly laughing when you said the saber-toothed tiger did it, because I was thinking the holes are just so, you know, round and everything. But anyway, it's been like a really eventful week, it seems, in the news for lay people. There's like two major things I've heard on the news. I don't know if you can address both of them. I'll try to be brief. But one was that they think maybe that they've, with the James Webb telescope, they found some evidence of something existing before the Big Bang. And then the second one was like they found additional biological material on an asteroid through the James Webb telescope. So maybe you could, I don't know if you've heard those stories. Maybe it's old news to you because you read the papers, the, you know, peer-reviewed papers. But, you know, on the news, they always seem to make a big deal about these things that kind of try to discount the Bible's account. So I have those two questions about those two things.
You will find these kinds of claims on the web. And, you know, my advice is don't trust any web article unless they give you a link to the peer-reviewed paper. And even if they do, look at least the abstract of the peer-reviewed paper. Abstracts are free to everybody, whether or not the paper is open access. And the abstract at least give you an idea of the tone. And what I'm finding is that very often the tone in the peer-reviewed paper is radically different from the tone that you see in the popular web article. So as you were mentioning, hey, we found signs of life in this asteroid. Well, when you read the peer-reviewed paper, what they're really saying is we found some prebiotic molecules. Then you look at the kinds of prebiotic molecules they're finding, you discover, well, they did find ribose. I mean, that was quite remarkable, a 5-carbon sugar, but at a very low abundance level, below a part per billion, which is going to be of no value to any origin of life model. And they find amino acids. That's quite a bit different than finding intact proteins or RNA or DNA. So when they say they found signs of life, then you need to say, okay, what do they mean by signs of life? And in fact, I was doing a radio debate just this past week where there was a scientist making a big deal about the fact, look, we found all these amino acids, and if we find the amino acids, you know, some naturalistic process could put the amino acids in together and make these proteins. Matter of fact, there was a big web story about the fact that they found what they called Nickelback. Nickelback was a strand of 13 amino acids that were joined together to two nickel atoms. And they said, you know, that has enzymatic properties. And they said, you know, that could be the beginnings of actual proteins. Now, this was not something they found in nature. It's something they made in the lab. So these scientists were able to take 13 amino acids, join them together with two nickel atoms and said, hey, we made an enzyme. Well, your typical enzymes are 4,000 or 5,000 amino acids long. This is only 13 amino acids. They found a short peptide. There's a big difference between a short peptide and an actual functioning protein. But I think what got them excited, they found three different ways of assembling these 13 amino acids. And therefore, they said, since we found three ways, this might be able to happen easily in nature. But they have found no evidence of this short peptide in nature. And so, and then, of all these amino acids, in all life forms, you need 20 amino acids, 20 distinct amino acids. How many of those amino acids have been found outside of biological systems? Only 8. 12 are missing. And of those 12, you've got a set called basic amino acids, which means they need a high pH in order to exist. And I've written a couple of articles at reasons.org pointing out that two of those basic amino acids, lysine and arginine, have never been found anywhere outside of biological systems or decay products of biological systems. And a team of chemists basically explain why we never will find them in nature. It's actually impossible for those two amino acids to be assembled under naturalistic conditions. And so when you read these articles saying, hey, we've been able to pull together these amino acids, well, how many of them are beyond the 8 that we have discovered outside of biological systems? If they have, then this is not evidence for the origin of life. Now, if I didn't completely answer your question, you're welcome to come back up to the mic.
Hugh, Mike Bonham wants to know, would you please address the Carrington-like solar flaring event of March 12 and 13 on the side of the sun away from the Earth? Some sources say it might have been 10 times the strength of the 1859 event. And I guess in answering that, tell us what the Carrington event was.
Well, there's been a lot of web noise, too, about this giant hole they found on the sun that measures several Earth diameters across. And when they mean by hole, in fact, one of our employees comes in and says, did they actually find a gigantic hole going down to the center of the sun? I says, no. What they found is a dark spot in the sun. It's basically a grouping of sunspots, a grouping of sunspots that at certain wavelengths made it look like a dark, big dark spot on the sun. However, it was, a lot of big flares were associated with it. And during the past several days, there's been some spectacular aurora that have been seen. And I was waiting to see if I could see it here. I didn't see it. I think it was 1989 I got to see the aurora borealis from right here in the Los Angeles area. So this wasn't quite at that level, but we did get some good flaring. In fact, most of the states, the 48 contiguous states, people were able to see an aurora about 3 and 4 days ago as a result of that event. But yes, people have been making the claim that that 1859 super flare that hit the Earth, actually I shouldn't say that, it wasn't at the level of a super flare, but it's the biggest flare that has struck the Earth in a recent human history. And they're claiming, they're making the point, there have been flares that big that have happened since 1859, but they didn't hit the Earth. Most of the big flares that come off of the sun miss the Earth. The one that happened in 1859 was pointed right at the Earth, and it knocked out telegraph communication around the world. People were even electrocuted by it. Telegraph operators were electrocuted by it. If we were to get another flare like that hitting today, in the U.S. alone, it would cause $2 trillion worth of damage and would actually result in a significant death toll, because for a lot of people in the U.S., they're dependent on the electric power grid in order to get their food. And look at all the food we refrigerate. And so if the entire U.S. power grid were to shut down, it would be a really big catastrophe. And I've written articles on this saying, we can protect the power grid if we're willing to invest a few billion dollars. Well, it's more than a few. We'd have to invest about $20 billion. The only power grid in the world that's adequately protected against a repeat of the 1859 solar flare is the Quebec power grid, because they got knocked out in 1989. And when they got knocked out, it caused $10 billion worth of damage. So they said, we better put in the surge protectors to protect it. But as far as I know, it's the only adequately protected power grid in the world. You say, well, how often do you get flares like the one in 1859? About once a century. So in that sense, I think it'd be worthwhile to insure ourselves against another repeat. But yes, that claim is true. There have been flares just as big as the 1859 flare that have happened since, but fortunately, they weren't pointed at us. In order to see a spectacular aurora borealis, the flare has to be aimed at us. So if it's off by a few degrees, you don't see anything. And of course, the majority of them don't hit us. But eventually, one will.
Hi, Hugh. $20 billion actually sounds pretty cheap, you know, compared to what it's going to be resolving. But that's not my question. My question involves William Lane Craig, who is a well-known conservative theologian. And I don't know if he's still there or not. He used to be associated with Biola University.
And so he's still there. He goes there once a year for about a month.
So what is kind of surprising is that, I guess my question is this, is that yes, his specialty is in the theological and biblical defense, but has he reached out at all to science to understand this new position that he's apparently adopting? Is there any scientific, does he pretend to have any scientific basis for it?
About that, okay, sorry. Yeah, we invited Bill Craig to speak at our 2020 Human Origins workshop. And by the way, the entire workshop was video recorded. You can watch it at reasons.org. You can see for yourself what Bill said. And we also invited some atheists to come, because when we do our workshops, we don't just want to be talking to our own people. So we purposely invite people who hold different positions than we do, and people who are not believers. And I've known Bill now for, 36 years, 37 years. So we have a long relationship. We've often shared the platform with one another. But what concerns me, it's not the bill that I knew 20 years ago or the bill that I knew 10 years ago. And what happened was he said he was getting all these questions on human origins and on Genesis. He's been teaching on it in his class in Atlanta, Georgia, because he has a class just like this that he teaches at a big church in Atlanta. And he's getting a lot of questions, so he said, I need to do a study. And so he decided he would write a book on human origins. And then theistic evolutionists heard he was writing a book on human origins. So they basically went after Bill and said, hey, here's what the science says. And so Bill basically adopted their scientific perspective. And I remember when he was at our headquarters, he was making this thing, well, Hugh, we have to accept the fact that Neanderthals are fully human. Look at these sophisticated spears they made. They're identical to Olympic. And I said, Bill, it's only one piece of wood. This is not evidence that they're as sophisticated as we are. But he was basically saying, based on that alone, I have to conclude that they're fully human. He was also persuaded by theistic evolutionists that the genetic evidence shows that humans have been here a long time. And so in his book that he came out with a year ago, he was basically saying that Adam lived at least 750,000 years ago, somewhere between 750,000 to 1 million years ago. What's unique about Bill is that unlike the theistic evolutionists, he is claiming that all humans are descended from one man and one woman. So he defends the Adam and Eve doctrine. But in order to be consistent, what he thinks the genetics is saying and what these spears in Germany are indicating, he claims that yes, Adam and Eve were real people, but we're not talking 100,000 years ago or 50,000 years ago or 130,000 years ago. We're talking nearly 1 million years ago. So that's kind of where he takes a different view than we do. But I remember speaking to Bill and saying, Bill, you know we have a different model. I know you've studied the theistic evolution model in detail. We're here to help you with this book project. And so we're available. You know, please talk to us. We'll help you with the scientific literature. But I think one thing I've been noticing about a lot of research theologians, they'll look at one or two papers in the peer-reviewed literature in isolation from all the other papers that are written on the same topic. So that's, again, something we're encouraging. Bill, look, I know you're citing this paper, but what about all the papers that dispute the claims in that paper? So there's a certain skill. I mean, you're a physicist, you know this. There's a certain skill to being able to read the peer-reviewed scientific literature. And you know, we who are, you know, have doctoral degrees in the physical sciences, we're trained how to read and analyze that literature. It shouldn't come as a shock to us that theologians lack that training, but it does mean we need to help them gain that training. And you know, what's wonderful is anyone can access the peer-reviewed literature. There's PubMed, and then there's a site sponsored by NASA. The NASA site archives all the physical science literature exhaustively, and PubMed archives all the life science literature exhaustively, and anyone can access those two websites. PubMed is all you got to do to put that in. If you want to get to the NASA website, it's adsww.harvard.edu. Harvard University partners with NASA to manage that website. And by the way, a book that's coming out later this year, I go into detail on Bill Craig's analysis in his latest book and my response to his book. It'll all be there with the citations. And I do that because Bill mentioned me by name in his book and didn't quite get my position right, so I felt I had to respond.
I guess what I'm a little bit concerned about is that we have theologians jumping into these areas where some science expertise is needed. coming to conclusions. And one exception that I can mention is Wayne Grudem at Phoenix Seminary, who has really used science and reached out to science to examine things. But I don't know if that's typical of a lot of theologians.
Well, that's where I admire Wayne Grudem, because as he came out with his book, Introduction to Systematic Theology, and I was amused saying, Introduction to Systematic Theology, and your book is 1,600 pages long. That's a little more than just an introduction. But what I do admire about him is he consulted with scientists before he made the scientific claims. So he reached out to me personally, and so that is helpful. But yes, you are accurate. These theologians are making all these scientific claims, and what I find really ironic, they're accusing me of being a scientific concordus and saying this is where reason to believe has gone off the rails. They actually think there's science in the Bible, and they're trying to concord the book of nature with the book of scripture, and are saying we have to abandon scientific concordism. But as I read their books and I read their research papers, they are scientific concordus. They're trying to concord the Bible with naturalistic evolution of the origin and history of life. And so it's like we're all scientific concordus, we're just different in the way we do our scientific concordism. Okay.
Hugh, about 10 years ago, you did an in-depth study on Neanderthals, and I think some of the key points that you had brought out, obviously, that brought to my mind how so different they are from humans, and I want to know if there was anything addition to the ones that I remember, is the Neanderthals couldn't cry. So anytime somebody claims I'm a Neanderthal, I say, no, I can cry. That kind of helps eliminate that possibility. So the tear ducts was one. The large barrel chest would be another one. The large nasal capacity, that's another reason the skulls were so big, was because they had to have the large nasal capacity. Those were the key ones that I think remember, obviously longer arms. Has there been more research into things that make them so distinctly different from us? And coupled with that would be, if you would give us a little insight into what proven lifestyle they had. Do they have clothes? Were they strictly still just meat eaters or whatever? Has anything new come about their lifestyle? So that'd be the two parts. One, is there any new things that make them different from us? And B, what was their life like?
Okay. Yeah, over the past 10 years, there's been a lot of new research on Neanderthals, and it's all moved in the direction of making them more different from us rather than less different from us. I mean, again, 60 years ago, in fact, I remember interviewing a physical anthropologist on our TV show in the early 1990s, and he was insistent that Neanderthals were anatomically identical to us human beings. So that's just, 35 years ago that claim was made. I don't know of any physical anthropologist who would make that claim today based on the new research. And yeah, you referred to some of it. The fact that when you look at the Neanderthal skull, if I can bring that back here for you. Here we go. You notice how much of the skull is devoted to the front part. And that's to allow for this huge nasal capacity because Neanderthals were living in a cold climate, and it was necessary for the cold air they were breathing in to be warm sufficiently before it hit their lungs. Now, we humans don't have a very big nasal capacity, but we wear clothes. And so we're in a cold environment, we have clothing on. And because of that clothing, the clothing warms the air before it hits our lungs. So this is evidence that Neanderthals were not wearing clothes because they were using their huge nasal capacity to warm the air. There is some claims in the scientific literature that Neanderthals may have been using capes or blankets. And this would be the fact that they were killing a large herbivore and then using the skin from the large herbivore as something they would drape over themselves. But certainly, they didn't have sewing implements. And the strongest evidence that supports the fact that they didn't have clothing at least as sophisticated as what we humans have, is that when humans went into their region, humans immediately began living in regions that were much colder than what the Neanderthals could live in. And the fact that we're so much less adapted to the cold than they are. I mean, you made the point they got a barreled body shape. Their arms are shorter. Their legs are shorter. They got a bigger nasal capacity. This helps them live in a colder environment than we human beings. We humans are wonderfully designed for a hot climate. We're poorly designed for a cold climate. But we can move into a cold climate because we can make clothing. And the earliest humans, we see evidence that they were sewing together small animal pelts. So what we see with Neanderthals, because they have found in Neanderthal caves remnants of a large kill, and you actually see the bones of Neanderthals, and the supposition is, well, maybe they were using the skin as a cape, but it's simply a maybe. There's no proof that they were actually using a cape. But there's a big difference between throwing a piece of animal skin over you, you still got a large amount of your body exposed to the elements, as opposed to humans taking, like say, 30 rabbits, skinning the rabbits, sewing the pelts together to make clothing that completely covers the human body. This is what enabled humans to go into a much colder climate zone than the Neanderthals. So, no undisputed claim that they were wearing any kind of clothing at all, and their anatomy would enable them to live in a cold climate. And notice there's not much evidence that they were living in warm climates. Most of the evidence puts them in Europe, southern Europe, where they would need to. And by the way, we're talking ice age conditions, and so they didn't need to be able to deal with a warm climate. They were fine with a cool climate. Now, if I haven't adequately answered your question, feel free to come back up. But there's a whole lot more in the scientific literature that makes a much stronger case that their anatomy was radically different than the anatomy of humans. Same thing's true of the Denisovans. There's a big debate going on. The Denisovans, which in this particular diagram would be up along the Black Sea area, is where they're finding them. And that little green spot that you see here, that's where you see the Denisovans. There's a debate going on, are they a distinct species from the Neanderthals, or are they simply a subspecies of the Neanderthals? I personally lean to the idea they're a subspecies because of the evidence of how highly inbred Neanderthals were. You know, we're talking a population size probably no larger than 8,000, which means you get a population density over that region of 0.002 Neanderthals per square mile. So it's going to be hard for a Neanderthal man to find a Neanderthal woman that's not in the same family or tribe. And so it's not at all surprising. We see some genetic distinctiveness with the Denisovans, but both of them are much more genetically distinct with respect to humans than they are to one another.
Thank you so much, Hugh. We're out of time. I want to thank everybody for their questions, both here live from the audience and online. Would you please close us in prayer, and we'll see you next week.
All right. Father in heaven, we thank you that you have made us so wonderfully and so fearfully. Lord, I pray you would help each one of us to recognize how valuable we are in your sight. You literally created this entire universe so we could have a home on this one planet, in which we can exist, in which we can thrive and discover you. Father, I pray you'd help each one of us not only to recognize our great value, but the purpose for which you've created us. Thank you for giving each of us a specific individual purpose to serve you. Help us to find that. And the Lord, may we recognize that we are special, not only amongst all the animals here on the earth, we're also special in the context of the other intelligent species you created, the angels themselves, due to the fact that we experience the grace of God. So may we be more open to receive grace from you and to be taught by that grace, so we'll be equipped in the future, in the new creation, to fulfill our roles that you have staked out for us there. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.